The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. These broadcasts present two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren, in a series of literary dialogues on the wisdom books of the Bible.
Mark, this is the last of our talks this summer, this fifth summer of our consultations, if you like, on each other's views about the Bible. And in this review of the wisdom books, we've mounted, as it were, from the worldliness of the book of Proverbs to the philosophic level of Ecclesiastes, and then plunged into what I suppose we must call the unclassifiable beauty and depth and significance of the book of Job. And before we say farewell to each other for this year, I think we ought to go over these three books again in a general way, because although Job does stand away from the other two, the three do somehow hang together. They hang together, among other things, in a technique which I haven't been able to observe in any other group of books in the Bible, and that is in the ending. Last week we were talking about the happy ending to the book of Job. It would have been intolerable if the book of Job ended on a gloomy note. It would have been out of keeping with the ultimate, what I might call, solemn optimism of the book. And so in Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, and the book of Proverbs, we have the deliberately contrived ending, which is pedagogic in intent and which is nevertheless, to me at least, natural. In the book of Proverbs, for instance, there was a good deal of girding at the danger that women represent in man's life, even though throughout there was a good deal of tribute paid to woman as well, in that she, as the mother, was equally responsible with the father for the upbringing of the son. Daughters aren't mentioned particularly. And her feelings, her status, is just as important as the husband's. But somehow, one would think that the editors, the writers, one is never sure which it was, of the book of Proverbs felt that some sort of climax should be added with regard to a woman, and there is that remarkable passage, which in the Hebrew, by the way, is in the form of an acrostic, on woman. And I do wish you'd read that out, the whole of it, because it does represent a very specific point of view.
Yes, I note in the text that it is an acrostic. That is to say, each verse begins in the text I'm using it at any rate, and the one you are too, begins with a Hebrew letter. Could you say first what the acrostic spells out?
No, it spells out just the alphabet. Each verse begins with the letters of the alphabet, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, and so on.
Oh, I thought that was might be it, but it isn't like some of
the devices acrostics often used. Do you find it in the Psalms as well?
All right, here is the passage which I'm very happy to read. Shall we say, injustice to women. A woman of valor, who can find? For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, and he hath no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax, and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ships, she bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night, and giveth food to her household, and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field, and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hands she planteth a vineyard. She girdeth her loins with strength, and maketh strong her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her lamp goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh for herself coverlets. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh linen garments and selleth them, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laugheth at the time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and the law of kindness is on her tongue. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done valiantly, but thou excellest them all. Grace is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and at her works praise her in the gates.
Well, that's a magnificent tribute, and I emphasize the word magnificent. Perhaps it's a little formidable, too. I think I've made the observation before in the course of our talks a year or two ago. This lady is a trifle frightening, I would say. Oddly enough, there's no mention here of her fertility.
No.
Which was one of the great considerations in olden time. There's no mention either of her character any other way, whether she was kind and gentle to her husband, whether it was fun being with her, and whether life was gay and jolly. But she is a tremendous figure. I suppose I can't help saying that marrying her was really like joining the League of Nations or going in for some other tremendous responsibility. I suppose that it couldn't be helped. He had to make amends for any slight that might have been implied in the earlier part of the book, and so you have this. She makes me think of one of those statues by Epstein, you know, those very reliable ladies.
Well, you know, she reminds me, too, a little bit of the man who says, these days, my wife is a wonderful woman. Women, wives don't always like to hear that. They would also like to hear him say, I love my wife, or as you
say, I'm crazy about her.
I'm crazy. It is fun to live with her, and all that sort of thing.
Yes. You see, this passage, grace is deceitful and beauty is vain, I can't quite agree with that. I don't think beauty is vain. I don't think grace is deceitful. And I don't think that women like to hear that said at all.
Well,
but it's the ending. I suppose it's the proper ending for a book of this kind.
Well, Maurice, let me point out, too, how much like a man this wife is. She is, in a way, the wife, the man of the household. She considereth a field and buyeth it. When, with the fruit of her hand, she planteth a vineyard. She does all the work. She not only all the household work, which you wouldn't be surprised at, but she does financial work. She bargains. She goes out and takes the part of the husband.
Yes, and he sitteth in the gate.
Yes.
Well, perhaps that's not a bad idea, Mark.
Well, I'm sure we all try to get our wives to do all the work that they will.
Now, the ending to Ecclesiastes is also, in a sense, typical. It rounds out the book. Will you read that, Mark?
The end of the matter, all having been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. For God shall bring every work into the judgment concerning every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil.
Now, one would think, and it's often been said, that this is artificially introduced in order that one should not be misled by any expressions of doubt or any apparently cynical observations. I wouldn't agree with that point of view, because the book itself, within, contains, as it were, its own corrective. The man is not a one-sided doubter, and this is the proper ending, not as a corrective, but as actually the final issue. One can't live on the level of Ecclesiastes. It is well now and again to acknowledge one's perplexities. It is healthy for a man not to repress these doubts as if they were sinful things. Nevertheless, life is lived ordinarily and in a daily way on the level of this last passage, the 13th and 14th verses.
And it's a wonderful thing to have a man as subtle as the author of Ecclesiastes, and as a man, and a man so capable of doubt and despair and weariness of both the flesh and the spirit. It's a wonderful thing to hear him finally saying what all men say. He says, in spite of my subtlety, in spite of the ingenuity in my brain which has enabled me to say these things that could disturb you and that do disturb me, in spite of all that, I finally say that I'm like every other man, I must say. The end of the matter, all having been heard, I having said all that I could say, written all the books that I could write, is fear God and keep his commandments. It's no more, no less true for me than it is for anybody else.
Yes, he's saying, in brief, whatever I've been thinking, whatever I've endured in the way of inner conflict, life has to be lived.
Yes, I'm reminded of certain men in the past who have said something like that. I remember Aristotle and his Ethics. I love Aristotle for having said this. He said, you know, I'm not going to explain what a good man is because everybody knows. All men know what virtue is. They may say they don't, but just try them out. In an emergency, they will know. And so even these days, when it's such a fashion to say that we have lost knowledge of the difference between good and evil, the very persons who say that, 5 minutes later, will be condemning someone because he has lied or because he is not to be trusted.
Very oddly, your quotation from Aristotle, Mark, makes me think instead of the opening of the Republic, Plato's Republic, where there is, as you remember, a long discussion as to what is the nature of justice.
Yes.
And I don't like that part at all. I don't like it because it ultimately leads to an attitude on life, an almost artificial concept of justice and an artificial concept of man's function, literally man's function instead of man's being. You remember that the Republic is built around the idea of the man as a particular function,
well,
not as man as the immortal soul.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree. In the beginning, a number of superficial definitions of justice are given by men who haven't thought much about it. The whole dialogue, which of course, as you know, is long, goes to a point where actually we leave the world of men. We try to understand justice somewhat as Job did. I wouldn't agree that justice in the Republic
I may have a warped view on this. You've heard it said, no doubt, that the Plato's Republic is a fascist book.
Well, then nothing is sillier than that.
I don't know. Men of considerable attainment and clarity of thought, Bertrand Russell, for example, considers it fascist in that the ordering of the world in the form which he thinks the proper one, this subduing of the individual to the character of the state and the placing of each person in a particular niche.
Well, but that isn't the end of the Republic. I would have to say to Bertrand Russell, if he said that to me, and I wouldn't hesitate to do this, that he isn't talking about the end of the book, which gets us quite out of the range of any state.
After he has disposed of the individual, he permits himself all sorts of high and magnificent thoughts when he has taught everyone that, listen, your job is this, and don't you get it into your head that you can be something else. I was thinking in particular that there's an enormous difference between the wisdom that is displayed there and the wisdom of the wisdom books in the Bible that we've been talking about. There isn't, as I seem to remember it, in the Republic, or for that matter, in what we might call the wisdom passages of the Greek writers, there is not the hominess, the prudential, if I may so put it, the prudential attitude of the writers that we've been discovering here in the Bible. Their prudence and their wisdom, in the sense of the ordinary daily intercourse between human beings. I came across a passage in Gissing. You know Gissing's Ryecroft paper.
Oh, yes, the novelist Gissing.
A very beautiful book.
Yes.
In which I found reflected almost perfectly what the wisdom books in the Bible aim at in their discussion of everyday behavior. And this is what Gissing says. How I envy those who become prudent without thwackings of experience. Such men seem to be not uncommon. I don't mean cold-blooded calculators of profit and loss in life's possibilities, nor yet the plodding dull who never have imagination enough to quit the beaten track of security, but bright-witted and large-hearted fellows who always seem to be led by common sense, who go steadily from stage to stage of life, doing the right, the prudent things, guilty of no vagaries, winning respect by natural progress, seldom needing aid themselves, often helpful to others, and through all, good-tempered, deliberate, happy. How I envy them.
Very nice.
A fine description?
Yes, I'd forgotten.
And don't you think that that is what the wisdom books aim at insofar as they deal with ordinary daily behavior?
Yes, and one of the interesting things to me about Jewish people generally is that their stories, their legends, and the way they talk about life all come finally down to a focus in everyday life, in what men do to each other, in what fathers and sons and daughters, husbands and wives do to each other. The stories are always very intimate. Merchants and customers and stores and traders at fairs and so forth. Every conversation that I remember out of Jewish stories, Jewish narratives, Jewish books, either long or short, brings me always right down to human experience, moment by moment. It's a terribly important thing. As if this race of men thought that quite possibly nothing was more important than the relations of men, minute by minute, in the world.
There's often heard the accusation that the Jews are a materialist people, precisely on those grounds which you have just adduced. You, however, adducing it as meaning the very opposite of their being materialist.
Quite the opposite. In other words, nothing is without moral importance to
them. Their point of view is, ideally speaking, that all our ordinary actions are interfused with a consciousness of God's presence. But what they insist on is, again, life has to be lived, which is the implied ending of Ecclesiastes, and in fact of the other wisdom books. All these reflections are true. God is with us all the time. Life has to be lived in the consciousness of his presence, but life has to be lived. At the time when these books were written, the Jewish people were already quite old.
Of course. Well, my sense is that they always have felt very old. The book of Ecclesiastes, it seems to me, is a very Jewish book in the sense that it speaks for a feeling that life has been going on forever and ever and ever, and there is no new thing under the sun. Yes, I've seen that. I've seen that happen. Sure, I know all about that. My grandfather knew it. Nothing is ever surprising, it seems to me, to a Jew. It isn't merely that he has lived the number of his years so far since birth, but he has been living somehow in the memory of his race, which is very ancient. There is nothing new. There is nothing strange. There is nothing that he hasn't somehow or other been prepared for.
In a sense, then, the wisdom books are the distillation of the experience of the people, and yet we find there's also a rebellion against the prudence and the, what some might consider the excess of caution in the wisdom books, or in that attitude generally. The prophets cry out against the misapplication of wisdom and prudence. Isaiah says, "Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." And Jeremiah cries out, "My people is foolish. They are wise to do evil." And he says again, "How do you say we are wise and the law of the Lord is with us?" There is a struggle always between the, you might call it the adventurousness, the spiritual adventurousness of the prophets, their leap into wild places of the spirit, and the caution of a people which, having lived long, is aware that there are rules which it is very dangerous to transgress. There are patterns which it is wise to follow. So there's a constant tension. And the literature of the Bible is, one might say, a literature of tension.
Oh, by all means. And the glory of it, it seems to me, is that it includes all of the extremes, from the utter plainness of those proverbs which tell you to behave the way all men understand all men should behave, just for the practical reason that life is unlivable otherwise. From the utter plainness of that, to the mystical heights and the depths of despair in Ecclesiastes and Job, and in many other parts of the book, for that matter. And remember, there's always the Psalms to be thought of, too, singing themselves on the theme of the greatness of God and his power. Whatever men may think of their own wisdom and their own prudence, there is always the ultimate recognition to be given, as in Job, as in the Psalms, as elsewhere, to the unspeakable power of God. Because it is the power of God that defines him, isn't it, finally?
Yes, the correspondence between man and God that you were talking about last week, that there is an interchange between them, which is an illustration as well as a consequence of the fact that God made man in his image. When we get back to the theme that we started out with, or the theme we started to examine, the nature of wisdom generally, we might perhaps take the highest figure incorporating wisdom in the Bible, the figure of Solomon, and we find there, at least I find there, a very remarkable contrast. Solomon, the wisest of all men, who in his wisdom fell into folly. You remember that very wonderful passage in which Solomon's wisdom is discussed. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart. By the way, the heart was the seat of the understanding among the ancient Hebrews too, as well as of the emotion. And largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, and he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005, and he spoke concerning the trees, from the cedar tree that is on Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springeth out of the wall. And he spoke also concerning the beasts, and concerning the fowl, and concerning the creeping things, and concerning the fishes. And men came from all the people to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. And this is the man who in his old age became foolish, just at the time when, according to the general outlook, a man rises to a climax of understanding. He let himself be led astray by the many wives that he wed. And the curious thing is that they were, I suppose, political wives, not really wives in the sense that we understand nowadays for that word. Man has 1,000 wives. It's obviously he marries them as a political gestures, indication of an alliance with some people.
Yes, also as a symbol of his power and of his riches. Incidentally, none of those wives was anything like the wife who is described at the end of Proverbs.
No.
Nothing so simple as that.
Couldn't have been otherwise, or if a large number of them were like that, they must have absorbed all of the industry of the country. They would be they would constitute the factory of the country.
As a matter of fact, Maurice, it just suddenly occurs to me that if Solomon is to be considered literally as the author of the book of Proverbs, you know, they are the Proverbs of Solomon and so on, if that is the case, and we can think of him writing this book and coming to the end and writing that passage about the perfect wife, there's a certain pathos in it, isn't it? Because he's describing none of the wives he has.
It's the offset. It is the offset to the Solomon who wrote the Song of Songs. And, of course, it is usually said that represents his, the Song of Songs represents his youth, and the Proverbs represents his reflective old age. They also say that Lemuel at the end, you know, in whose name the last chapter is given, is another name for Solomon, although what warrant there is for that, I don't know. You know, here is something, Mark, that I've been saving up to ask you on this question of wisdom, this character of wisdom, this mysterious thing, this indefinable and yet unmistakable thing called wisdom. There's a passage in Proverbs, you remember it, in which we are told, it is a tree of life to those that take hold of it. This tree of life is the tree that's mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the whole Bible, when we are told that Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden were shown two trees. One of them was the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the other was the tree of life. And when they had eaten of the forbidden fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they were driven out of paradise, lest, God said, they eat of the tree of life and live forever. Here we are told, pursue wisdom. It is the tree of life. He that takes hold of it takes hold of the tree of life. It looks as though this is the reversal of the driving out from the Garden of Eden, that the restoring to the Garden of Eden is, inasmuch as you have tasted knowledge of good and evil, and most of the wisdom here has to do with the wisdom of good and evil, then steep yourself in it so completely fill yourself to the brim with it, and you will actually return to paradise. You will be given the tree of life to hold on to.
Yes. Adam and Eve, having been cast out of Eden, have to learn by themselves. In Eden, the implication was, I think, that they would have been taught by God, or perhaps they didn't even need to be taught. They somehow would know without effort. They are cast out to live the lonely life that humanity lives, and it's a very difficult life with much art and much struggle. We must learn what it is that is true. And that is what wisdom might very well mean here. Of course, God, you remember, rewarded Solomon. God told Solomon to pray either for riches or for wisdom. Solomon elected to pray for wisdom, and God said, I will give you both.
Yes. One of the first occurrences of the word wisdom, in line with what you're just saying, Mark, one of the first occurrences is when Moses is making his valedictory address to the Israelites shortly before his death. He said, see, I have taught you statutes and ordinances. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding before the nations. The pursuit of this type of wisdom is, in the last admonition of Moses to the Israelites, is the destiny and the purpose of the Jewish people.
That reminds me of our discussion last year of the Ten Commandments. Not that I want to remind you of it this late. In the present discussion, the Ten Commandments presumably had to be handed down on tables. They weren't ten understandings that men might arrive at easily by themselves, were they? They had to be known. They had to be revealed in that sense. So that wisdom, we come back again to the idea expressed everywhere, that wisdom has its ultimate source in the mind of God.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the last program in the Eternal Light Summer Series, which has presented Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren in a discussion of the wisdom books of the Bible. Be with us again next week when we will resume our regular Eternal Light dramatizations. We Live By is presented by the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, and is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the NBC Radio Network.
This is the NBC Radio Network.